Hey everybody, and welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight for a discussion of his five favorite movies by Mr. Alex Lawson.
Patrick, in honor of the newly minted Golden Globe winner Matt LeBlanc, I ask you and the rest of the F This Movie audience, how you doing?
Nice. Happy New Year to you, Alex. It seems like you haven't been on in a long time, but I think that's because of this series that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I was glad to take a back seat to your lovely wife, and who's also gone. Eric and Mark
have all gone.
I knew that there was going to be a tremendous burden on you to
be
watching everybody's five favorite movies, and I was let's not try and shoehorn another one in here.
Thank you.
I'm glad to be back.
Since you mentioned the Golden Globes, do you care to comment on the Golden Globes?
Oh gosh, not really. I feel like we should though. I mean, we are a movie podcast. There's so much, almost to every award show, it's sort of a race to about who can make the most jokes at the most people's expense, which I'm all about. But I want to step back from that for a second and actually. If you can hear that, I'm going to actually applaud the producers of the Golden Globes yesterday because they decided, I don't know who was in the truck or if that person was in a bad mood, someone said no long speeches because everybody got the playoff music yesterday. And I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Right from the outset, Kate Winslet won some goddamn thing for something or other that nobody saw. And this is Kate Winslet, and she just gets played off, and I'm like, oh well, it's early, maybe they don't want to fall behind. And then a couple more things happen, and then gosh, you got it. Oh yeah, Meryl goddamn Streep. Meryl Streep got the trombone flaring up, and I'm like, well, okay. The only one who didn't get it, and I think with I think if they had their druthers, they would have, was poor old Sidney Poitier, but they were about to.
Well, yeah, he wasn't really accepting an award though.
He was introducing
Helen Mirren introducing Morgan Freeman.
The only other thing, again, like I said, not related to any of the other two things I've already said, I am not convinced that that guy from The Artist is not still a Fred Armisen character. Or is still not a Fred Armisen.
Right.
There we have it. Yep.
Today was, we're recording this on Monday, January 16th, and of course it won't come out until a little bit later in this week, but today was a big day in F This Movie news. Big shit going on, which oddly enough is what—that's the review that some people give our podcast. We announced the F This Movie Film Festival to take place on Saturday, February 4th. And if you don't follow the blog at fthismovie.blogspot.com, and you don't like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about.
Nor do you probably want to participate.
Plenty of people get us by other means. Mainline us right into their veins. So I'll talk a little bit about it. We wanted to have a film festival, but seeing as even our contributors are spread out across the country, much less our audience spread out across the world, there's no real way to do it in one central location and have everybody show up. We could do it in Chicago and maybe four people would be there. But Adam Risky would be one, so that would be cool. So we decided to do it all sort of online. So if you want to participate on Saturday, February 4th, you'll have to secure five or six movies, to be named in a few days. They're all from the year 1982 because that's the theme of the festival. And then we're just going to start watching them at noon Central US time and, log on to Twitter and follow F This Movie at twitter.com/FThisMovie. And we're just going to be talking about the movies and making jokes and just acting like we're all in the same room together, but doing it all via Twitter. If you don't have a Twitter account, if you've been avoiding the Twitter, but you want to participate, just get a Twitter account, follow F This Movie at twitter.com/FThisMovie, and then delete your account the very next day.
You could do that. But also, if you don't even want to go to if you just want to read the tweet, you don't have to have a Twitter account to read Twitter. You can read the F This Movie Twitter
account.
That
is true, but I feel like if you're going to participate, you might as well participate.
You some comments.
Yeah, stuff. Exactly. Yeah. Or just let us know that you're there, because we want to know who's all watching these point. Movies with us. And then at the end of the festival, we're going to be recording our big 100th episode spectacular, on which we announce the winners of the F This Movie Win Our Stuff contest, which is still going on. You can email your favorite show moment to fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're going to throw all the entries in a hat and pull the names out on the 100th episode, and people are going to win DVDs that we have that we no longer want. There's some excellent, excellent stuff that's going into the
what
various
kind of
boxes.
Stuff?
There's like Criterion stuff. There's a brand new Blu-ray of The Rocketeer, one of your very favorite movies.
Oh yes, of course. I didn't even know they rolled out a Blu-ray.
Yeah,
that.
Just
That's
came
wonderful.
Just came out in December, and Joel Young, who runs the excellent fan site TheRocketeer.net, has offered to donate a brand new Blu-ray of The Rocketeer to one of the winners. So that is so awesome. I've got a bunch of stuff. You know, it's not all going to be Doug's old copy of Harvard Man, everyone. There's going to be good stuff in there, too. So you do want to enter if you've been dragging your feet. Like, what am I going to do with somebody else's garbage DVDs? There is good stuff in there. And who could turn down a free DVD for just, you know, typing an email? It's easy.
Even if it is Harvard Man, who's to say?
Exactly.
I mean,
maybe you've never seen Harvard Man. Maybe it's the one hole missing in your James Toback filmography. Maybe you've seen When Will I Be Loved. Maybe you've seen The Pickup Artist. Maybe you've seen Two Girls and a Guy. Maybe you've seen Black and White.
Can he keep going? Can he keep going?
Maybe you've seen The Gambler.
Boom.
I might be out.
I think you can just make something up. I don't think no one's going
to... Something with Warren Beatty. I'm sure they've done something together. So, but Harvard Man is missing. And you're like, I want to hear Adrian Grenier discuss philosophy with Al Franken while tripping on acid. This is the movie for you, everyone.
This is the contest for you.
It absolutely is. fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And as long as we're on the subject, let me read some of our more recent entries. I'm going to try and go through them kind of fast because some of them are a little bit long, but they're worth hearing. Scott Phillips writes in, my favorite episode or moment was having Erica come back and listing some of her favorite movies on the last podcast of 2011. Then he self-identifies as one of the, to use his words, assholes. Maybe the only one to comment on his dislike of the schmoopy-heavy Bridesmaids episode. I'm fully aware that commenting on what is considered by most as lighthearted banter negatively and rightfully lumps me into the curmudgeon category among your listeners, a category to which I may be the only member. I assure you, Scott, you are not the only member of that group. Several of us on the podcast actually qualify. Yeah. All of this brings me back to the last episode as I sat listening on the last day of 2011. I enjoyed the fresh insights that Erica brought to the show. Music seemed to be a recurring theme for her, as were the bodies of Tom Cruise and George Clooney. Their film work, of course. Talks a little bit about Tom Cruise, makes a very funny comparison about how he turned into Elvis in the 80s. 15 to 20 years of Tom Cruise channeling Elvis's career roles. The new bartender, the new pilot, the new driver on the circuit.
Yeah, the cocky young blank.
Yeah, Roustabout, Spin Out, and Charo.
Oh, man.
Yeah, right? It's great. And then he says, while I don't agree with all of her choices, I greatly enjoyed the enthusiasm behind her picks and how she unabashedly linked them to the experiences surrounding them at the time. All of us do. It's these experiences that we bring into the theater that can often make or break our connections to a film, especially when it comes to a film making a major impact on us. You also referred to coming out of a film changed somehow after a film greatly impacted you, and I instantly thought of a film. Then you mentioned the same film, Reservoir Dogs. In any event, anytime a woman can love Boogie Nights, much less dress up like Roller Girl, that is a woman to be listened to, respected, and maybe even threatened by sexually. Kidding. However, it does show that she's smart and has an incredible sense of humor. In short, the show was great and a pleasant surprise to end the year on. I hope Erica will pop up again soon as a guest. Thanks for the podcast memories. Erica will definitely pop up again as a guest because we live in the same house. We got another email.
It's going to be hard for you to shake her. So,
yeah, right? It's been hard so far.
Sort of like bound by law, maybe. I don't know.
Here's an email from Brad from Australia. Hi, guys. How can I possibly single out one great moment of the last 90-plus episodes? While it's fresh on my mind, the Home Alone episode was a blast. Don't think I've laughed that hard for a while. Almost crashed my car. Keep up the excellent work in the new year. And then I responded, hey, thanks for the email, but maybe you're confusing us with another podcast. We've actually never done a show on Home Alone. to which I got...
I was going to say, I am.
this response. Sorry, I messed that one up. Everything else I said was true, just thought of the wrong movie. I came on board with your Anchorman podcast and have been hungry for your podcast chocolate each week. Great chemistry, and you guys think as I do. Keep up the excellent work. I like the use of the expression podcast chocolate. Luis says, one of the more memorable lines and moments I still think of from time to time is near the beginning of your summer 2011 show when JB was discussing a screening of a certain Stephen King adaptation and subsequently went to one of the theater employees and stated, sometimes they come back, ... for a refund. Another excellent moment from early on in the history of the show was Patrick singing a few bars of Cyndi Lauper's song near the end of the Goonies episode. Which I think might have been Doug singing the Cyndi Lauper Goonies are good enough. I think. Also, the serious story at the end of the Taken show.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No. I said all good moments. Very
yes.
Good. Yeah.
Jeff from San Francisco.
And shows that we actually did. So that's good.
Jeff from San Francisco writes, I've been listening to the podcast since the beginning, but this is the first time I've ever written in. This is definitely the beginning of a hustler letter, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
The possibility of getting a random DVD was too much of a lure to resist. I fell behind in my podcast listening because of the holidays, so the most recent episode I heard was the one inviting listeners to share our favorite moments from the podcast. My first choice would be the time Marcon told the story of how he was kidnapped as a toddler during the episode about Taken. However, I suspect that will be the most popular choice by a mile. And you're exactly right, Jeff from San Francisco.
Yeah.
As an alternative, I would like to mention something from the episode about Showgirls, where Doug told the story of how Patrick could answer correctly all the questions from a Saved by the Bell board game without any trouble at all. That episode also had Patrick periodically chiming in with his top 10 list of quotes from Showgirls. The one that stuck in my mind was, and if it happens again, you're going to jump to your conclusion. I'm still trying to figure out if that quote makes sense in context or not. Keep up the good work. Peace. And finally, another entry from JM, which reads, just another entry trying to get better chances to win yours and your friend's stuff. Hopefully JB's too. I want to see what's in that box. And of course, that immediately makes everyone say, what's in the box?
What's in the box?
There it is. I love Doug's story about when he became the Havoc as a little kid in his unsuccessful attempt to tie it up with his love for Top Gun. Patrick completely losing it with laugh-out-loud belly laughs is a moment that shines in an otherwise still awesome dressing down of the Simpson-Bruckheimer blockbuster machine formula. Runner-up funniest moment, Erica interrupts the podcast with her Top Gun cookies. Wish you guys had taken photos of them just so we could have seen them. I really want to see what the goose dog tag cookies looked like. keep this great podcast rolling, Patrick and company, and please throw this and my other favorite moments emails in the pile so I have a better than one chance of winning JB's and everybody else's cool stuff. So there you go. Those are all terrific submissions. Thank you guys so much for writing in. It's been so much fun. And, you know, again, I don't mean to just ask for, like, gratification. Just write in all the stuff you love about our show. But it really has been so nice to read all the emails and know that people are enjoying the show. And so keep writing in, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, and win our stuff.
You know, you really got me off my game. I was hoping somebody would have a fond memory of a show that I was on, but it didn't pop up.
Let's try and make it happen here. maybe you could cut yourself on accident.
I don't know.
Remember that hilarious time Alex passed out from blood loss on the podcast? It could happen.
It was frightening. Yeah.
It could happen. Somebody I think recently
it's fine.
Maybe this was on the Twitter. Somewhere somebody was talking about our last Airbender podcast.
He said he fell asleep like 20 minutes
in. Yeah, there
it
is. So it doesn't quite count as a favorite moment. But
better man than us. No, it's fine.
Oh, if only. Hey, Alex, have you seen anything good lately?
I really have. I've seen something so good that I am tempted to break a cardinal rule of mine ever since I've been watching movies with any kind of critical eye. And that is...
You saw Contraband?
I did. Let me see. What was I? You really got me off. Yeah. I saw a movie that, were it not for your strictly and stridently enforced deadline of our for our top 10 submissions, would have made my top 10 of 2011 list.
Okay.
But I am an advocate of you made your list and then you stand by it. I mean, you could, in theory, retroactively plug in a bunch of things you didn't see or didn't see. But yeah. I finally saw a young adult.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Has anyone talked about that on the podcast?
We talked about it a little bit just on our top 10 show.
Yeah.
But that was it.
Right. I really, really enjoyed it. And I got to say, I mean, Jason Reitman all of a sudden is, I mean, we did the a show about Juno.
Yeah, we did.
And he has yet to make a bad movie, in my estimation.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, it's only, what, four?
Yeah, but that's pretty good.
But that's, you know, these days. And furthermore, I, for the record, if I were allowed to amend my list, I'd probably plug it in around six or seven. And then I would bump everything down then one, and that means I would lose The Descendants, which was in the 10th spot. Which is fine, because actually the more I'm sitting with The Descendants, the more problems I have with The Descendants.
But, and yet it was the Golden Globe winner for Best Picture Drama.
Because it was so dramatic.
Well, it's not really a comedy.
No, but I mean, Matthew Lillard was in it, and that guy's hilarious. So, let me see. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, so young adult.
Yes.
It also made me think about, for as much as people like to hate on Diablo Cody, and we certainly covered that territory in Juno, I think it's pretty clear, at least, you know, between this, and I did also finally see Jennifer's Body a long time ago. But between Juno podcast and now, mm-hmm. Not like a one-trick pony with Juno. I mean, I really thought Young Adult is a really sort of emotionally complex and sort of layered story with a character, much like Juno, that may not be rooted in like the most, you know, the most concrete reality. Like, yeah. has enough aspects to her persona that kind of make you think, you know, whether it's a composite of a lot of people she's known, or I think we've all known people that exhibit some of those qualities. It was very funny, and then it just really went some places, and it didn't, and like when it went to the dark places, it didn't feel like a cheap trick of like, oh, now here's where we pivot and go dark.
Right.
Really, really enjoyed it.
I didn't expect aliens to show up. I'll admit that caught me off guard, but
weird,
I feel
right?
like they served a function. Two things. One, I agree with you that she writes these interesting characters, and like Juno, that they're sort of on the surface, they seem sort of like these broad writers' constructs, but I think they're sort of filled in with enough well-observed details that you can kind of talk about them and say, like, yeah, but this seems real and this seems believable. And I think she includes some details that not a lot of writers do about people. So I hope that she sort of continues on the path that she's going. I don't know how many young adults she will have in her, hopefully more than Jennifer's Bodies, because I was not a huge fan of that movie. And two, I was listening to a different movie podcast where they were talking about this movie, and one of the people on the podcast kept referring to the movie as young adult. And it started to make me crazy. Like, I understand if you say adult instead of adult, right? But literally everyone around you is saying young adult.
Saying young adult.
Don't you ever stop and just say, all right, I'm going to stop saying young adult. Because that's, you know, when no one says young adult lit, they say young adult lit. And that's what it's in reference to. So maybe just course correct a little bit and just take one for the team and say young adult. Don't stand so firm to your convictions. No, it's young adult. That's all.
Wait, something hang on one second.
Something that annoyed me.
There are other movie podcasts?
I don't see why anybody would bother listening to another one.
No, but let's see, what else did I want to talk about? Oh, yeah, I, for no real reason, I couldn't sleep the other day, and I was looking at what was on HBO On Demand, and I ordered a movie that I just kind of missed when it was in the theaters, because I had sort of written it off by looking at by seeing the trailer, because It was a movie that I always refer to as sort of a cash in, and that movie was Due Date. Todd Phillips, Zach Galifianakis, and Robert Downey Jr. Referred to it as that because it just seemed like it came out in 2010, like so much on the footsteps of The Hangover, that it just seemed like, oh my God, like Todd Phillips and Zach Galifianakis have another movie right now, this very next. Seats, you know, I can't remember if it came out in the spring or summer of 2010, but it seemed so abrupt.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like, oh, let's watch these people be funny again. And Robert Downey Jr. was kind of wanted to, now that he's like kind of funny in the Iron Man movies, he like wants to do a straight up comedy. And so I never really gave it much thought, but I ended up really, really liking it. And I like most Todd Phillips movies. I like The Hangover 2 more than you did, but we've already discussed that. But I really like it. It felt like a I don't know, kind of a logical descendant, well, not as good, but a logical descendant of like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And
by,
I thought,
by descendant, you mean ripoff?
I mean, to the extent that like odd couple road trip movies are ripoffs anymore. Like, I mean, it all. I mean, there's so many versions of, you know, offshoots and stuff.
There's The Odd Couple. There's The Odd Couple 2.
There's Road Trip.
There's Out to Sea.
There's
Boat Trip.
There's both Grumpy Old Men's. what are we thinking?
I don't know. I'm fascinated to hear that you really liked that movie. I was not a huge fan.
I really liked it.
I thought it was a comedy without the laughs.
Oh, I disagree. I don't. I mean, I just I want Robert Downey Jr. To do more of that stuff. Like, I mean, I just
be annoyed in a movie. Like, that was his one role. Is like he was annoyed and kind of unlikable. And again, I don't need every character in a movie to be likable, but you need somebody to sort of identify with. And theoretically, it's him because he's the straight man who's being annoyed by Zach Galifianakis. But because he was so sort of harsh and he was such a prick, like, you couldn't identify with him. And then Zach Galifianakis is from another planet. I mean, occasionally there would be something very funny. There were a few details about him wanting to be an actor or whatever. There were definitely some decent jokes in the movie, but I just felt like the whole thing to me seemed lazy.
I don't disagree with the fact that he wasn't terribly likable, but I actually sort of, that's kind of what I wrap my arms around actually a little bit. I really liked that. To whatever this says about me as a viewer, I almost embraced the sort of mean-spiritedness of it all. Like, especially when they sort of shoehorn in a very sort of meaningful and cathartic scene that takes place at the end of the Grand Canyon.
But you can't have it both ways, I don't think. I don't think you can ask us all of a sudden to be moved by that moment.
No. You didn't let me finish, though. Like, okay. Because I felt that way, I was like, well, this is kind of weird. And then it ends, that moment passes, and then he slams his head into the hood of the car again.
Right.
I'm not saying we're reinventing the comedy wheel here. I mean, I just...
No, it's fine that you like that. No.
The fucking movie.
I'm glad.
So
that's available on HBO on demand right now, you think?
I would have to
if
think
people
so.
Wish to watch it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's on. I don't know what its Netflix status is.
I don't. Netflix, unfortunately, is not getting very many current movies. You know, you'd have to, and there are no more blockbusters. So basically, you have to find a red box.
What about you?
I'm not one for making New Year's resolutions.
Yet
here in this new year, I have resolved to try and go through some of my DVD and Blu-ray collection and watch a bunch of movies that are deemed to be classics that I have never seen, because there are so many holes in my movie watching, especially when it comes to classic movies, and it sucks. I love movies so much, right? And I've never seen Gone with the Wind, and yet I've seen Empire Records 5 times, and I don't even fucking like Empire Records. Why have I wasted 10 hours of my life watching this movie and watching it again? I don't like it.
Yeah.
Or like I've seen Hot Shots probably like 3 or 4 times, right? I don't have an opinion on Hot Shots at all. It's just this thing that I've seen more than once, and yet
it owns 7 hours of your life.
Right. And I've never seen The Rules of the Game or whatever. So I'm trying to go through, and I do this every like twice a year, and it usually ends pretty quickly where I'm like, I got to get through all these old, you know, French and Japanese movies and stuff. And then I'm like, oh, it's too much work. I'm going to watch Armageddon. So I have, however, seen 3 movies from my collection that were previously unwatched. The first is not necessarily a classic movie. It's actually much more recent, from 2009 or 2010. It's called Mother. It's a Korean film by Bong Joon-ho. It's great. It's on Netflix Instant. Everybody should watch it. I won't say too much about it, except that it's about a woman whose son is accused of a crime and the lengths to which she will go to prove his innocence. But the two classic movies that I watched that I had never seen before were Paths of Glory, the Stanley Kubrick movie from 57. And that's interesting because I think just last week on the Top 10 show, Doug was talking about how there aren't a lot of movies that take place during World War One. And then a few days later, I'm watching Paths of Glory, which takes place during World War One. It's an incredible movie. And, you know, there's that quote about how it's very difficult to make an anti-war movie because as soon as you start showing war on film, it looks exciting. It looks like an action movie. There's gunfire and explosions and there's music and but I think Paths of Glory is usually one of the movies that's sort of pointed to as like, well, this one comes close. And I would agree with that. If it's possible to make an anti-war film, I think Paths of Glory comes very, very close. Really great. Everybody should check that out. Probably everybody already has. I'm last to the party on this. And the even more embarrassing was I had never seen The Third Man, which I finally just saw. I had never seen it. What do you want from me? And, you know,
I actually did a thing I hate just now. I hate when people do that. I rescind that comment. The old what?
Because but, you have not seen The Third Man?
No, I have. But
you just when people are like, I can't believe you haven't seen Caddyshack 2.
I kind of aired into that territory, and I really apologize.
Right.
It was more surprised that you hadn't than like, how dare you? No, right. That's all.
And that's the thing. It's like there are I love movies, and I'm on this podcast every week talking about movies. And if I admitted to some of the movies I've never seen, people would be like, well, why are we listening to your opinion again?
Oh, I feel like a lot of people have that, though. Didn't we do a list about this one time, or did that –
That's,
we meant to?
It's coming up, supposedly.
Okay. Well,
I don't know if you've submitted your. Yeah, I don't think you've submitted yours.
I don't think I have.
Other people have, so get on that. And I'm trying to close that gap a little bit before the list can come out. So I'd never seen The Third Man, and you know, there's nothing I can say about The Third Man that hasn't been said. It's great. It's a classic for a reason. It's so good. It's one of the best. If you're into black and white, it has some of the best black and white photography I've ever seen. Great musical score, awesome direction. Orson Welles is pretty kick-ass.
Where does that rank for you in terms of Orson Welles? Like, does that in the Orson Welles canon?
I mean, he didn't write or direct it, so he's just an actor in it. So I don't necessarily consider it in the same terms as like Citizen Kane, you know.
Wait, what am I thinking of?
You are thinking of Transformers the movie.
Oh, that's
where
right.
He plays the voice of Unicron.
You know what? I
you're thinking of Touch of Evil.
I swapped it in my head with Touch of Evil. Although yes, I have seen both of them.
So, okay.
Well, I withdraw my question in that.
Thank
you.
But
you liked it though, yeah.
It's unbelievable, and it's nice to see a classic movie, and because it's happened to me before where I'm like, does this movie have the reputation that it has?
Yeah.
But to see The Third Man is to instantly understand why it has its reputation. It is also available on Netflix Instant. If you, too, have never seen it, you should. It's great, you know.
Fantastic.
Yay, movies! Let's talk about the reason we are here tonight, sir, and that is to discuss your five of your favorite
five
movies.
Of mine.
Yes.
A quick story.
Because Dirty Dancing Havana Nights we will not be talking about tonight, but that's on the list.
I couldn't do it because there was no way I could talk about that and four other movies. Like,
right,
I mean, it just would have taken up the whole time.
We would have
had to split the podcast in like three different parts and nobody's going to listen to all that. But yes, it is on the list. No. This is, I just kind of have like a group of like, you know, 15 or 20 movies that are like that I consider to be essential viewing for me. I wanted to talk about a couple different ones. I mean, like the Graduate is obviously on my list for a lot of reasons, but I know you guys already did a whole show about it and I didn't want to do that. And then your lovely wife, Erica, scooped me on two of my other favorites. Yeah. I would have, had I had my druthers, I would have loved to have talked about Boogie Nights and the Royal Tenenbaums. And then when I saw those, I'm like, well, we're going to have to do some alterations.
Cock blocked.
But hey, listen, it was fine. And frankly, you guys had a much more enlightening conversation about both of them than we probably could have, or at least as good.
It was like an era cock block.
You know, there's like a team picture of the essential Alex Lawson movies, and these are all in the picture. If I were to assign some sort of theme to this bunch, it would be the theme of primacy. And what I mean by that is that these movies, in a lot of instances, exhibited certain qualities that when I saw them, that was like the first time I had ever had a motion picture do that exact specific thing to me. There have been other movies that have done the things that these movies try to do better. Are you following me here? Is this turning? Is this turning into word salad a little bit?
No. I'm interested to hear what it is you're referring to as you talk about each specific movie. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well. Okay. Anyway, the first movie is a movie that I think ends up on a lot of the list that we so often refer to here. Unfortunately, the film school snob list. And that movie is The Usual Suspect.
Yes, it does.
1995. It does.
There's a lot of good movies on the list.
But I just wanted to sort of have it known. Like, I know it's like, oh, how original am I? I love The Usual Suspect. God. Originality, by the way, is not a theme of this list. No one's going to be like, oh, interesting.
That's why you should have gone with Havana Nights.
I know. That would have turned some heads and gotten some clicks. Everyone's going to be like, oh, everyone loves these fucking movies. I love The Usual Suspects, and basically when I – saying what I said before about seeing something for the first time, I saw this movie when I was about 12 years old, and it was the first time where I felt legitimately duped by a movie. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, you were 12. That's kind of like – like seeing a really crappy magic show at some kid's birthday party and thinking that like that is like a real thing and you're carrying that forward as one of the greatest pieces of entertainment you've ever seen in your life.
That's number four on your list, right? Is the magic show you saw at your friend's birthday party?
I did. Yeah. Garbanzo the Great. I don't know. Anyway, The Usual Suspects, I feel like, I don't know if we've had the conversation about like how long you can go before spoiling stuff, but I mean,
well, listen, if you've not seen The Usual Suspects at this point, tune out for the next 5 to 10 minutes and come back, because we can't really have a discussion about The Usual Suspects,
right.
especially in this context, without sort of talking about the end of The Usual Suspects.
Yeah. So the first time I watched it, you know, you're watching all of this sort of violence and mayhem play out. Being narrated by Kevin Spacey, you know, the lone survivor of this whole bloodbath. And then when, you know, when I say I was duped, what I mean by that is that, like, my instant sort of little kid reaction was like, well, he's sitting in the chair and he's the only one left. He must have done it.
Okay.
Just because that's, like, the logic that I was employing at the time. I don't know why, but I just like assumed like, oh, wouldn't that be kind of interesting? The Usual Suspects catches a lot of flack because it gets accused of cheating a lot.
Right.
And that is because the character of Dave Kuyon, played by Chaz Palminteri, pretty much tells Kevin Spacey that, you know, another character perpetrated all of this. You know, it was Dean Keaton. As, you know, Kaiser Soze. And that rubs a lot of people the wrong way when it's then revealed that Kevin Spacey was, in fact, pretending the whole time and all of this. And then he kind of the way Roger Ebert wrote a very famous, you know, criticism of it. You know, and it's like, I don't really understand it. And to the point that I do understand it, I just don't care, which is a good line. But one that I that has never really washed with me, because it's not just like the movie is cheating by telling us one thing and then by presenting us with a set of facts and then pivoting the other way. I think it's the reason that it stays with me is because that the character of, you know, Dave Kuyon was duped in the way that we are supposed to be. But I mean, he arrives at that through his own analytical process, and like that is the fact that is all part of the, you know, grand plan for him to actually arrive at that really, really sticks with me in a way that sort of makes me elude all of the sort of cheating talk. But,
well, you know, we've talked before at some length, usually in discussions about M. Night Shyamalan, about the twist ending, mm-hmm. and that there are plenty of movies that have a twist just for the sake of having a twist, basically. Mm-hmm. And that audiences, for some reason, will often respond to those because they were tricked. And it doesn't matter if the movie plays fair or if that particular twist adds anything to the film. It's just like, hey, I was tricked, and that means the movie was good, and I just want to shake them and say, but it cheated, and blah, blah, blah. The Usual Suspects, I understand that the twist is sort of for its own sake, but at the same time, I don't necessarily think it's cheating because the movie is about... That's what the movie's about. It's about...
It is about deception.
Right, like, it's about this long con. It's about constructing a story that is a lie, you know? It's about making up a fiction to trick someone. And so I think it's okay to... Yeah. To be tricked at the end, you know? And I won't say that I saw it. I saw that movie the day it opened in, what, 96?
And 95, I think.
Was it 95? Okay. And I was blown away by that ending because I did not see it coming. And I won't say that it was like, you know, I think the movie still exists in people's minds because of the ending. I think without the ending, we're probably not having the conversation about The Usual Suspects. I'm not saying it's not one of your favorites, but I'm saying people aren't necessarily still talking about it without that ending. But that's true of The Sixth Sense. I mean, that's true of more than one movie. And one of the things I like about The Usual Suspects is that I think even without the ending, it's a really good movie. It has...
That's what I was just about to say. I wanted to obviously begin somewhat awkwardly, in case you can tell by all my fits and starts, with the ending, because you kind of, like you said, you kind of have to have that conversation. But every time I rewatch it, I find, like, in the most trite fashion, the journey is as fun as the destination. I mean, like, it's really well cast. I mean, Stephen Baldwin has never been relevant, never approached the relevant. Well, I mean, no, wait a minute. I know you're going to throw some Biodome at me, and that's and that's fine. That's fine.
I was going to go Viva Rock Vegas, but whatever. Oh, I mean, whatever.
Yeah. The point is that it's really well cast, and it's just so fun to watch these guys like hang out and talk about crime.
Yeah.
I, at the risk of oversimplifying my affections for it, it really does kind of, at least in this sense, boil down to like the cinema of cool. I just think it's really cool to watch.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that's used as a criticism of a lot of, movie making techniques. But I don't think it's really, like we said before, I don't think this stuff is like being made to seem cool for the sake of coolness. I think this is, you know, part of the story that's being told.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody, you know, sort of has, you know, is their own cog in this machine. From one perspective of the actual job that they're trying to pull, and then B, the fact that they're all simultaneously having a job pulled on them.
Right.
It just, you watch it from a couple of different, obviously, now we're talking about the twist again.
Right.
But any movie that has that, I mean, you watch it with a little bit keener eye on subsequent reviewings, and that it always sort of makes for, and there were so many interesting little moments and things that seem like throwaways and that aren't so much throwaways and all that.
All of the, you know, the guys basically could sort of be the same character because they're all sort of these tough crooks, and yet they find ways of distinguishing, I think, all the characters in interesting ways, and all the performances go a long way towards doing that. And it's really well directed. It's the movie that kind of put Bryan Singer on the map. I just think it's a really good example of a modern day film noir. One of the best, I would argue. And, you know, there are plenty of people who would say, well, I saw The Usual Suspects and I don't care for it. Because the more you talk to people about movies, and obviously if this movie has afforded us a great chance to do that, the more you find out that every single movie you can name will have every single kind of reaction from someone. You know, you can think of just the lamest movie you can, and someone will say, yeah, but I really love that movie. And you can think of the best movie you can, and somebody will say, that movie's garbage. So... The Usual Suspects, especially because of the way that it was sort of built up amongst the sort of film school set, is victim of that kind of backlash of just like, hey, it's not all that, and the twist is lame. And Gabriel Byrne, you know, I think he does a good job. He's a little bit of a blank for me in the lead. I think he does.
You think so?
What he does in Usual Suspects, I think he does much better in Miller's Crossing. I think he works in The Usual Suspects because I think he plays that part well. And again, he's more of almost a symbol in the movie than he is a human being, you know?
Yes.
So I think it works. If I could really quick tell you this story about Usual Suspects, 95, I guess, whenever it came out on video, I was dating a girl. This was years before I met my wife. This was like my high school girlfriend or something. And she was sick. And so I went out and rented her a bunch of movies, one of which was The Usual Suspects. And I had to go home. So I was like, all right, I'm going to put on The Usual Suspects. You got to watch
it. And you had seen it. You saw it.
I had already seen it. Yeah, I saw it. Okay, yeah, the day it came out. So I was, I put it on and I left. And I called her the next day. And I was like, so what'd you think of The Usual Suspects? She goes, yeah, it was great. It was really good. And then we're talking for a little while. And somehow, at some point in the conversation, it is revealed that, like, she fell asleep for the last 10 or 15 minutes. But, you know, she really liked it. And I was like,
oh, no.
Hang up the phone. Why are we talking right now? I was like, you gotta get off the phone and go watch the last 15 minutes of that movie. Why do you think I'm sitting here praising this movie? I mean, again, it's a good movie without the ending, but like to say like, oh, I really liked it without
pursuant to the conversation we were just having.
No, finish that movie. And I honestly don't remember what she said after she did watch it, because all that mattered to me was that she hadn't seen the end and like didn't seem that bothered by it. I'm like, oh no, you should probably go finish that movie.
Anyway. I just really dig like the rapport that all the actors have. They're all good. I mean, aside from William Baldwin, they're all like Stephen Baldwin. Oh my goodness, yeah. I've committed Baldwin fraud. they all have, you know, they are like pedigree guys who really know what they're doing, and it's just really cool to see them all hanging out. The scene that always jumps into my mind when I think about them as like an ensemble piece.
Yeah,
it's the lineup scene where they all start hanging up.
Give me a key, fucking Hong Kong. What the fuck?
Yeah, what the fuck? Oh yeah, all that. I mean, like, you see him just kind of laughing, and they're all kind of laughing in a very specific way. Gabriel Byrne is laughing, but he's kind of just got his hand over his mouth, and it's just those little nuances that it's just, like I said, I mean, it's just really well executed. It's well directed, it's well written, it's well acted.
What more do you want?
Not a whole lot to complain about in Usual Suspect department.
What is next on the list for you, sir?
Next on the list, I almost feel like I stepped on myself a little bit, just sort of praising Usual Suspects as an all-around achievement of writing, directing, and acting. This next one, even more so, because I have never seen a movie that just did everything so well. Every little aspect, from its production to its execution to just the tone, just left me completely spellbound in the movie theater. And that movie is Adaptation from 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a confession. I have thought about pitching Adaptation to you as its own show for a long time, but I get really scared because every time I try to form a coherent thought about this movie, I talk myself in circles in a way that – and I mean that in a good way, and it reflects well on the movie, because every time I try and like approach it from a different way of like, here's one reason why Adaptation is great, and then I start talking myself into, oh, and that also bleeds into this.
Right.
You know, we talk on the podcast a lot about movies that are really ambitious and movies that try to do a lot of things. And this was the first time I've ever seen a movie attempt to be so many things and do so many things and achieve it on so many different levels that I am just blown away. The thing that I always tell people, from a screenwriting standpoint, I don't know how one sits down and writes Adaptation. And I say that with the knowledge of even knowing that Adaptation exists.
Right.
It's a tremendous gambit on the part of Charlie Kaufman, who wrote it, which, I mean, clearly he was like, it almost seems so trite to say, oh, I'm having some serious writer's block. How about I make a movie about that? And then that, in and of itself, becomes its own theme in the movie. And then furthermore, a testament to the studio that put it out, which I can't remember right now.
Sony.
I can't imagine what the... I mean, Charlie Kaufman had built up a little bit of a cache because, you know, being John, people love the weirdness and sort of offbeat nature of being John Malkovich. So, I mean, they put a lot of faith in this whole thing, because can you imagine being some like studio executive who is all about like making money and like a bottom line type of guy, and someone walks into your office with this kind of pitch?
Right.
Oh, I'm adapting this book, but it's about me trying to adapt the book, and it's actually about me trying, you know, right. And here I go again. I'm already starting to do what I have always feared doing.
It's very depressing because, you know, studios are always happy to have two or three maybe like prestige movies, and both Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze had sort of made names for themselves by that point. And so, you know, it didn't make Sony look bad to have their new movie coming out. But at the same time, like, I think that's gone away even more. Like, I think adaptation was an easier sell in the early 2000s than it would be now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, like I said, I mean, you know, you fold in all these themes, forget about the baseline theme of like what it's like to be a writer. I mean, everybody's seen the movie about how frustrating it is to be a writer. I mean, that's well-worn territory. But then to fold it into, you know, a critique of the whole screenwriting process and the, you know, the two different types of things, and to have it be so on the nose with having identical twin characters. I'm going to get to Nicolas Cage in a second. Before I forget, I have a pretty great story that somewhat involves adaptation. When I was in college, I took some kind of like media writing class. And wouldn't you know what my textbook was? It was Story by Bob McKee.
Yeah.
I just shit my pants when they passed out the textbooks, because, you know, this huge, like, and even like the actual cover of the book is so like monolithic looking, right. Like in the movie, like it's just like, it's like on a matinee. It just says Story. I was disappointed when my professor was not an angry Brian Cox, but he did kind of look like the guy. And I thought, well, this is probably meant to be. This is also the movie I point to whenever any Nicolas Cage critics come out of the woodwork. I mean, I just put this one right on the table and say, show me who else could have done this. Think of all the overused words you use to praise actors. I mean, it's like magnetic, hypnotic, really, really incredible, incredible comedic timing.
Yeah.
Playing two very distinct, you know, well, wait a minute. Now, you're not of the opinion that Donald is like a figment of his imagination, right? Because that is a school of thought.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
That is idiotic.
That's floating around on the internet. I mean, I don't know if that's like because like...
The movie gives you no indication that that is true.
There are like whole pages about this.
You cannot just invent a reading of a movie without anything to back it up.
You are clearly not familiar with the internet. I mean,
I'm really not.
Anyway, but no, yeah, I mean, of course, they're like both real living, breathing people. And my gosh, it's just fantastic. It's not even what you would call a comedy. I don't think it would be in the comedy section of a movie store, but there's not one single line uttered in any scene with the two of them that I'm just not busting my gut laughing. Like when he's just going down, mom called it psychologically taught, and he's mispronouncing denouement, and oh my God, you could go on and on. It's just,
yeah, it's just really funny. And it's a really funny sort of critique of a certain school of thought that, you know, to sort of run Hollywood. And how funny that the screenplay that the Donald Kaufman character writes has honestly been turned into more than one Hollywood movie, including
Later,
Identity with John Cusack,
which came out the next year.
Yeah, and you see like, that and you're like, this is, did Donald Kaufman fucking write this?
It's the three. I remember you. You came up to me when we were you were the one who told me like when Identity came out. We were having a conversation and you said, have you seen Identity yet? And I said, oh, no, I haven't seen it. You're like, well, it's the three. I'm like, oh, great. Like, they're all him.
No,
isn't that fucked up?
Yeah, and you can't, you know, obviously it made Meryl Streep so funny, and she's so good in it. And,
yeah, and I haven't even talked about Meryl Streep or Chris Cooper yet. You see what I'm talking
Meryl,
about?
Meryl Streep, though, to be fair. I mean, obviously she's a great actress, but she's genuinely a really funny person, I think. Like,
oh, yeah.
And I don't think that ever – I don't think that comes across enough in movies. And so it's nice to see adaptation make good use of that. Obviously, Chris Cooper is good, and he won the Oscar. Although, to be honest, he's always been my least favorite part of the movie. And that's just personal taste. That's not because I think he's doing anything wrong or whatever. And it's not fair to compare Due Date to a movie like Adaptation. And yet, here, because Adaptation, like you said, it's not necessarily a comedy but it's definitely very funny, and it's a drama, and it's one of these movies that's just like, well, it's completely its own thing, you know? But you talk about Due Date, which is like sort of this comedy, and then at the end tries to earn this sentiment. An adaptation does that, I mean, incredibly well at more than one point in the movie that every one of these...
That's a masterclass on mixing tones.
Yeah,
you know.
That every one of these characters has this backstory, and the Chris Cooper character, obviously, specifically, is involved in, you know, one of the three worst movie car crashes ever. It was so jarring when I saw that in the theater.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, just this super sad backstory. And then, you know, a lot of people sort of criticize, and again, mild spoilers for adaptation coming up, but I actually, when I saw the movie in, what, 2002, is that what you said?
2002.
Yeah. When I sort of realized where it was going near the end and what it was starting to do, I thought it was great. I got really excited, and I thought, oh, that's so clever. But that's, a lot of people criticize the movie for doing that.
Oh, see, now that's what I love about it. I mean,
right,
they
accuse that of being cheap or easy, and maybe it is. I don't know, but I think it's part of the joke, and so I really like that. And then, so you're kind of laughing at what the movie is pulling off, but then it has this yet another moment of just horror, sadness, and it's so moving. The last scene between the two Nicolas Cages. Yeah, really.
And they're singing the song, and like the only reason that the song is in the movie is because like Donald thought it would be appropriate to put that song in a thriller, and then it just like that's fucking stupid. But then it pops up in this movie, right. And it works because oh my god, I can't. Yeah. I'm speaking in sentence fragment. Like it's not. This is not compelling. I apologize to everybody listening. It's just
well, but honestly, this is part of the reason for the whole favorite movies podcast idea. Yeah. Was because, I mean, there are a lot of movies that I love that I don't want to touch in terms of a full podcast.
I mean,
because either I'm intimidated by like, well, I worry that I won't do it justice, or I don't want it to turn into the Chris Farley show, or it's just like, and this is so great, and this is so great. So I figure if we're limiting it to a couple minutes where we could just say, this is so awesome, and this is what this movie means to me, and you should see this if you haven't, that might be a more effective way to go.
One last thing, and then we'll move on.
Yes.
I love this movie so much that I actually became like I threw myself into the like true aspects of it. I read the original like her Susan Orlean's New Yorker article.
Okay,
and then I started to read the book, and then that gave me an even greater appreciation for what Charlie Kaufman does. Because have you tried to read that book? It's like
Hell
I mean he's
no.
not kidding. He's not kidding. Like it is. I can see, like, I mean, I can't imagine, like, it is kind of unreadable. I mean, and she's a good writer. I think she writes great stuff for The New Yorker and all this stuff. She has a new book about Rin Tin Tin that's great, incidentally.
I know of it, but...
Side notes. We can talk about that later, but that's great. So I'm not, like, shitting on Susan Orlean. The last little my life true story about... adaptation is that not that long ago, it was like just at the end of last year, for no real reason, I was a little drunk and I was on Twitter, and I felt like calling the actual Susan Orlean a lonely, desperate, pathetic drug addict on Twitter. And she responded to me. This is the only famous person who's ever responded to me. I couldn't believe it. I know no one likes, like, no one's interested in, like, hearing, like, Twitter stories, but I was just like, I was just like, oh, she'll probably just, whatever. I was like, is she even going to get it? Is she going to be mad?
Right.
And she just responded with a very, like, she just said, ha, very nice.
Okay.
So she's clearly embraced it.
Well, that's good.
So, I mean, she is not any of those real things. But anyway, I mean, if you've somehow if adaptation has somehow eluded you, amend that.
And again, it's certainly not everyone's bag.
I don't think
Charlie Kaufman movies are for everyone. I think a lot of people have a problem with Nicolas Cage, even in one of his, you know, awesome sort of restrained performances like this. But yeah, definitely people should seek it out. Yes. Next on your list, sir.
Next stop. We're just fresh off the holiday season. And I realize it's now become almost like it was an offbeat choice, and now it's like such a mainstream offbeat holiday film choice. But my next choice is Die Hard.
Yeah.
It's a movie I'm sure it's been mentioned on the podcast before, just sort of as an example of how awesome things are.
Yeah.
This is not a joke. I've watched this every Christmas with my mom for the last, 10 years or so. What can you say other than that it is a template-making movie? I mean, it is kicking off the guy who is up against it all by himself, impossible odds. And that's been done in awful iterations since then. A number of Jean-Claude Van Damme movies jump to mind.
Well, it's like when people start calling tissues Kleenex. Like, Kleenex is a brand, but we just call them all Kleenex now. And Die Hard has become that, where it's like you use it as a way of describing another. It's Die Hard in a mall. It's Die Hard on a plane. It's Die Hard in a hockey rink, you know.
In a hockey arena, yeah. It's thrilling and irreverent and funny. I mean, I just every single time it comes up, every Christmas, I have my mom rolling in, on the floor in stitches, because I am always game for a, no fucking shit, lady. Do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
Nice.
That's
your Bruno.
Bruno. But yeah, I don't even, help me out here. I mean, I'm trying to sort of.
No, I have no idea what you would say, because I think it's a great choice as one of your favorite movies, but at the same time, it's like, well, of course it's one of your favorites. It should be one of everyone's favorite movies.
This is what I'm saying.
Die Hard.
I mean, find me a flaw. Like,
No, there is sort of a flaw, and Ebert was actually the one who pointed it out, and he, in his famous, 2.5-star review of Die Hard, which is blasphemy, he does not like the Paul Gleason character, because his contention is that the Paul Gleason character exists only to be wrong about everything. And that's true. I mean, I actually think the movie is pretty tight in terms of its structure. Something I noticed the last time I watched it, which was maybe a year ago, like the way that it sets things up in the beginning that pay off in ways both big and small near the end, even Holly's watch, which is set up very early on, and then you just forget it as this silly detail, is the thing that snags Hans Gruber at the end and all that. But the Paul Gleason character is extraneous, and if he didn't exist, I don't think it's a worse movie. Having said that, I'm fine with him. It's always fun to watch him be a prick in a movie. And
oh yeah, I mean, he is kind of the example of the cop who has no. I think it's important to have like not a foil, because he's not like a foil to John McClane, but I mean an example of like a cop doing all the wrong things. I don't know. I mean, I guess you're correct in saying like it wouldn't be worse without him. I mean, it does make for some pretty great comedy. I mean, you get the butt fucked on national television line. You wouldn't have that if he wasn't in the movie, Patrick.
True.
And yeah, you're right.
I'm coming around.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and then you sort of have to have some kind of go between before the asshole FBI agents get there. Since there has to be an officer in charge, I mean, I guess I would make him a contrarian dickhead like Paul Gleason is. And also, no one does that better than he does it.
No, he's great at it.
Yeah. To the extent that you would make the argument that he's extraneous, I mean, what he is asked to do, even if that is extraneous, is he does it with flying colors.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
I love how it's a movie with a victory for pretty much anybody who's not a terrorist. Like, and I'm not even just talking about the very, obvious choice of having Carl Winslow, blow away the blonde terrorist. I'm talking about even like something that always makes me smile, never fails to make me smile, is just when the limo driver punches
Argyle,
out Argyle just punches out Theo,
the quarterback. Is toast. And that's such an interesting choice on the part of the filmmakers, because they know that you like Theo, and hasn't done anything truly detestable, whereas everybody else has. So it's like, well, we're not going to kill Theo. He doesn't really have that coming. All he did was punch in some numbers and hack a safe.
Yeah.
He doesn't deserve to be killed for it. So we just get Argyle punching him out.
I love thinking about the world that Die Hard lives in. I want to know, I want to know, but let me be clear. I don't want to know. I don't want a Die Hard prequel or something. But isn't it interesting, how all of these terror, were they all, it's clearly Hans's plan. He must have just gone on, they're all so different. And I'm not just talking about, that they're different ethnicities, but they all have, really different personalities.
Yeah.
The guy who's pretending to be the front desk guy, always, that scene where Carl Winslow comes in. I know it's Reginald Del Johnson. I'm just going to keep calling him Carl Winslow.
That's fine.
I love the little subterfuge he runs. He's watching a football game and just, I got $50 on him. He made a believer out of me. He's playing it really cool for a guy who's running a terrorist operation. Die Hard. Have you heard of Die Hard?
I've seen it once or twice. No, I still contend that it is the single best action movie ever made. And can't be overstated because it gave us Bruce Willis sort of as a movie star. And the thing that I always loved about Die Hard, even as a 10-year-old kid who was obsessed with watching Moonlighting, when the trailers started coming out for Die Hard, and I, of course, wasn't able to go see Die Hard in 70mm in a theater when it came out. I had to wait for it to come on cable and my parents would let me watch it. But I was so intrigued by the fact that this guy from Moonlighting, who was just the funny, wisecracking guy, was going to be this action hero. And I, even at 10, I was like, well, that is interesting. That is not what I would expect. I was used to Rambo and Commando. And I was already way into action movies, but that's a neat choice. And that so rarely works when they cast somebody sort of way against type and the guy turns into a huge fucking movie star in the span of a single movie. It's like you watch Die Hard and Bruce Willis is created in front of you.
Yeah.
And it makes me so sad to see his current performances where he's so checked out and removed, and to go back and watch Die Hard and he's just working his ass off in the best way.
Oh yeah. That's the other thing. He almost gives an underrated acting performance. I'm not even saying that he's it's not like Olivier or something, but it's just it is a one-man show. Has to be, he has to be, convincing as a tough guy, and he's also hysterical, and he has to be sort of, you have to also believe that he's clever enough to outwit them, and it all kind of works, even though he's clearly not, some kind of super genius. A lot of the terrorists probably have higher IQs than he does, but,
well, listen, I don't know if they've been tested. Patton Oswalt in the AV Club inventory book writes a very short piece about Die Hard and gives it credit for being a movie, especially in the era of Rambo, where the main action hero tries to sit it out. He tries to get the cops involved and steps back and says, I can't do this. And it's only obviously when nobody else can, that he steps in. And that, of course, has become the convention in every movie. But just that this is one of the first movies that gave us this huge action hero that is sort of the reluctant action hero,
All right.
Two more. What's next for you, sir?
The first movie that ever made me, God damn it. This is why we make movies. When I saw it, I was 8 years old and I'm just that's why I go to movies. And that movie is Jurassic Park, 1993, Steven Spielberg. And this gets a special mention. There was a theater in downtown DC. I've mentioned it before. It's the East Street Cinema in downtown D.C., and they play midnight movies, and they finally got, after much, there was this big, Twitter campaign, and, on their Facebook page, people were asking them, get Jurassic Park for the Midnight Madness, the Midnight Madness, whatever. And they finally did it, and it was this big thing, and I got tickets. The earliest you can get, the earliest you can buy tickets for the midnight shows are a month before, and there was a line, a month out. It was December 2nd was the showtime, and I went there on November 2nd. And that was the earliest you could get them, and there was a line. I was like, "You guys here for Jurassic Park tickets?"
Wow!
And I went there, and I was so excited. I went with a friend of mine, and it was. I mean, I know people like this movie. I was not aware of the cultish nature of all of these fans. It was just this great jovial atmosphere. You guys have talked about this within the context of the Music Box Massacre, about how a lot of times the viewing experience kind of elevates it. And I always liked Jurassic Park, but almost after seeing it that way, I knew for sure I wanted to talk about it here. It always was one of my favorites. But it was great. I mean, you know, people were shouting out the lines, but not in a way that was, like, overly obnoxious, and people, like, just giving rounds of applause to these, like, great sequences. There was a great article on Grantland.com that sort of probed into what I was discussing before about this, like, cultish nature of Jurassic Park fans. There's this legion of people that read into it, like, there's all kinds of, were you aware there's, like, a feminist, like, school of thought here? Like, the dinosaurs are all girls, and, like, it is a male attempt to control such and such. Oh, man, like, it's, like, there is, and that's just the surface of it. There's, I mean, it is, like I said, I mean, isn't this why someone decided to point a camera at something and make you think something was happening that wasn't? Like, I went to the theater, and there was, like, fucking dinosaurs walking around. Yeah. Couldn't believe it. And it's amazing how well that stuff still holds up. There's one scene in the initial T-Rex attack, in the night sequence when it's raining and Jeeps are parked out in front of in the Tyrannosaur paddock. And oh, gosh, it's just such a seamless mix of, they use these like big elaborate animatronics and, you know, cutting edge CGI. There's one scene, it's from inside Malcolm and Grant's Jeep.
Yeah.
And you see the Tyrannosaurus head, and it's kind of like sort of nosing at their car, and you can tell that it's an animatronic.
Yeah.
Like you can tell it's a real thing.
Right.
That's before you. And then it is at this moment that the kids start flashing the flashlights,
mm-hmm.
and it pushes in, the camera pushes in, and then it pushes in to the extent that the T-Rex head is out of the frame. It's lifted up out of the top of the frame. And then it walks over to the kid's car, and that is obviously a CGI thing, because it's like walking smoothly. But like, you don't even know. I mean, you would only notice it. Like, I mean, it doesn't even compute in your head, but it's just like, it's creating this environment that is just out of sight. And I saw it at the exact moment. Like I said, man, I was 8 years old. Like, everyone goes through a dinosaur phase. I was right in the crux of mine.
Yeah, that's pretty perfect.
And then here they were walking around, and it's just, it's also, while it's not going to be on anyone's like acting reel or anything, I think the actors that are in the movie like really are very keenly aware that they are not the stars. There's stories floating around that, like, I guess Kevin Costner was like a studio favorite to play Grant.
Mm.
And yeah, no, I mean, not quite. Also William Hurt, which would have been,
no,
like, I mean, interesting, no. But not, no. Definitely not the same.
The name I always heard was Harrison Ford.
Oh yeah, that's it. That's it. Not Kevin Costner.
Oh,
That's what I meant. Yeah, Harrison Ford. Sorry.
Yeah. See, to me, and I like Sam Neill in the movie, but to me, if it's Harrison Ford, I think it actually might be a better movie.
Oh, you think so? Like, I mean,
and it's hard to improve because I think Jurassic Park is pretty perfect. Like, I really,
I mean,
do,
I but. Think. I don't know. I mean, I feel like it becomes a Harrison Ford movie then. I mean, I don't know if he can, like, you know, I realize
I don't think anything's going to take away from the dinosaurs. And so I think it might be nice to see one human performance, at least meet the level of the, you know what I mean? Like, Samuel's fine. He's good. He's serviceable. But like, with Harrison Ford, I think it becomes something almost iconic, even just to see him in the hat, and it reminds you of Indiana Jones. And to watch him hate being with the kids, I think would be much more entertaining than watching Sam Neill hating being with the kids. Again, I like Sam Neill in the movie. Who knows? I mean, we're speculating, obviously, with Harrison Ford. Maybe the whole balance gets thrown off. I honestly don't know. But
yeah, it's interesting to think about. But I mean... everybody is kind of punching their weight. It is where Jeff Goldblum attained Jeff Goldblum status. I was 8 years old. I know that he had, I know that he had like been in movies before, right. And like had a career, like, you know, he did The Fly and like all this stuff. But like, I remember walking out and like I wanted a pair of glasses like he had. Like I wore glasses when I was a kid, and I wanted those like thick tinted glasses, 'cause I just wanted to be like Ian Malcolm.
You know, this was back in the days where I went to see movies a bunch of times in the theater. I don't obviously have a chance to really do that anymore. And the summer that Jurassic Park came out, I mean, I saw it a bunch of times in the theater. And part of that was because it was just so much fun. part of it was because I was like, well, it's never going to be the same way.
I know. That's why I was so excited.
You have to see it in a theater.
That's why I was so excited when it was coming back, because I haven't seen it since I saw it in the theater in 1993. Right.
But it's such a clever conceit, too. And I know that it's based on the book, which I haven't read. But I think in some ways the conceit works so much better as a movie, because the whole idea is, you know, people are constantly comparing the movie to, well, it's like a theme park ride. It's a summer movie, and summer movies are always compared to roller coasters. You know, it's like a theme park ride. But here's this theme park ride that's sort of commenting on theme parks, and how sort of clever that works. I just rewatched it maybe a month ago. It was shortly after you told me it was going to be on your list, and it had just come out on Blu-ray, and I wanted to. It had been a number of years since I'd seen it. I was amazed by a couple things. One, the fact that for as exciting as the movie is and its reputation for being this thrill ride, there are essentially three action set pieces.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe they're just so good that they sustain in people's memory this idea that it is this crazy intense thrill ride, because there's basically just the three sequences. That T-Rex attack, I mean, obviously you can't say enough good about, and I had forgotten that the whole thing plays out without any music whatsoever, which is such a great choice. And I've been working on this theory lately about Steven Spielberg, that he has two kinds of movies that are great. One is the movie that he has to make. Schindler's List, Munich, there are Color Purple, that those are always pretty great, even AI. And then there are the movies that nobody else but him could have made. And sometimes I don't think the movies that don't work are the ones that don't fall into either category. And that's, you know, Hook or Lost World or Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Those don't fall into either category, and that's when he kind of falls apart. The Terminal, he didn't have to make The Terminal, and other people could have made whatever. Jurassic Park is a movie, obviously, that nobody else could have made, I don't think, as well.
At that time,
Spielberg. And it's amazing, because you watch some of his best movies, whether it's Raiders of the Lost Ark or Jaws or whatever, and everybody just marvels at how fucking great those movies are. And of course they are. Jurassic Park, I don't think, gets quite the same praise. And I think the reason is because he makes it seem so easy.
Yeah, that's, I mean,
you don't feel him trying in the same way that you do with Jaws and Raiders. Those maybe are earlier. They're a little bit more show-offy. You feel him maybe because they're more rooted in like practical effects or stunts. I don't really know, but like Jurassic Park just seems like such a simple commercial movie, and yet, as you just pointed out with that Tyrannosaurus Rex sequence, how well planned out and executed the whole thing is. But he makes it seem so easy that I think people don't give him enough credit for what a good job he does with that movie.
Yeah, almost sort of. I wouldn't say underrated. I think people have a good grasp on how good Jurassic Park is. But yeah, not as passionately discussed as those other two. But my goodness, it was awesome, and it just keeps being awesome. It was the first and only time I've ever done the thing that kids in movie theaters do, where you actually cover your eyes at a scary thing, and that is the moment when the Dilophosaurus spreads out the bill and spits at him. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it. I squinted through my eyes for like half a second, and I only saw like the veil. I'm like, that is horrifying. And of course, I could still hear it. The sound. Like we haven't even talked about like the sound effects. Like, what the hell do dinosaurs sound like? The sound mixing is it's a masterclass in sound mixing.
Yeah.
I mean, what, I don't know what a Tyrannosaurus Rex sounds like, but god damn it, that's got to be pretty close.
Right.
I mean,
it's you know, so many movies are trying to do, especially now, more and more every summer, and summer has spread throughout the year, that every movie is essentially trying to replicate what Jurassic Park did. Every movie is expensive spectacle, thrill ride, whatever. And it's great to go back and see a movie, you know, that's almost 20 years old next year that hasn't really been topped in terms of like doing what it wants to do and what all these other movies are trying to imitate. And like you said, still absolutely holds up, you know?
Yeah.
Real quick, before we go to your last movie, which do you prefer, Lost World or Jurassic Park 3?
I think we may have even talked about this before.
Oh, you hate Jurassic Park 3. Yes.
I hate Jurassic Park 3.
You are not alone, by the way.
No, I am not, and I'm not, like, a big Lost World fan either. Like, I mean, I know that's got problems, too, and I think it's, like, kind of mean, and, like, kind of uglier.
I still contend that it is Spielberg's worst movie.
You think it's worse than Hook?
Yes, I do. Oh, I do, and we can talk about that on another show. We probably should have talked about it on our Hook show.
We probably should have, yeah. Wow.
We might have, actually. I might have explained why I thought it was worse, but... Okay. In your last movie, sir.
Last one. A movie that means more and means something different slightly every time I watch it. When I made, at the end of 2009, I took to the internet to make a best movies of the decade list because I am a douchebag and I assume that people demand to know these things about me. And anyway, I made a list of 50 movies, and this was at the very top of the best movies of the OOs or the aughts or whatever. And that is 2004's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, directed by Michel Gondry, and the second appearance of Charlie Kaufman in the intro. So that gives you a hint as to what I think of his work. You and I have talked about this before, about there are certain movies about relationships that mean a little more to you as you experience certain stages of relationships in your life.
Yes.
Whether you have just started or you've just broken up or you're getting someone back. Every time you watch, you know, there's a group of this. We talked about this before. Chasing Amy is like this. High Fidelity is like this.
Yep.
And Eternal Sunshine is maybe the king of this kind of movie, in my estimation, because I'm with someone now. I've been with the same girl for almost 2 years, and I'm very happy. But I mean, I wasn't always like this, and you know, we've all been through some dark times. To have just a small, what is ultimately a small little movie that's not very long and not very complicated, at least in its you know, just sort of, you know, pieces, tackle so many, you know, depths of human emotion and like the way you sort of give yourself to people and just tackles the issue of like letting down boundaries and, you know, allowing people to come in and the risk that you take when you do that. And then to have it sort of, I mean, there's lots of romantic comedies that have, and I wouldn't necessarily call this a romantic comedy in the sort of conventional sense. A lot of relationship movies tackle those ideas, but to do it in this way that is kind of a quirky, offbeat, science fiction-y type of thing where it sort of takes everything and turns it on its head. It starts with a very sort of simple idea where, you know, what if I could forget somebody? And it makes it a literal conceit. And it thinks right. about, you know, it sort of forces you to examine what that would be like if that actually happened.
So. What I've always liked and appreciated maybe most about the movie, aside from the performances and its construction and all that is really great, is that idea that you're talking about. That I think most movies, specifically most Hollywood romantic comedies, like to break things down in these very simplistic terms and tend to treat adult relationships the way that a child would see them.
Yeah.
And so I want to forget all the bad stuff that made me sad is a totally acceptable notion, I think, for most Hollywood movies where the couple just, let's put it all behind us and we kiss at the end and everything's fine. And I like that Eternal Sunshine not only asks this question, you know, would you forget everything if you could, but, and spoilers for Eternal Sunshine coming up, but ultimately comes down on this idea that, like, no, that's part of it too. And I'm not willing to let go of even the pain because I don't want to lose this thing that meant so much to me. And I choose to hold on to that stuff. And I think that's a really honest and sort of adult way of looking at relationships, which so rarely happens in
very movies. Refreshing. Yeah.
When I saw Eternal Sunshine in 2004, honestly, and I don't know that I would still make this case, but like it ended and I sat in my seat thinking, man, that was maybe one of the best movies I have ever seen.
I know.
And here's the weird part. I have never seen it since. And I have
never seen it since.
And I have no interest. I have never felt like watching it again.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
I truly have no idea.
This is now what we're talking about. This
I've
is,
seen
wow,
Empire okay. Records five times.
Yeah, we're back to this again.
I've never been compelled to rewatch Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And I wonder, as you were sort of introducing the movie, if I were in a different situation, if I were not a happily married man of 7 years with my wife for, 10 or so, would I be watching Eternal Sunshine more? Because sometimes when you're sort of feeling angsty in a romantic sense, you want to watch a movie that reflects the way you feel.
Yeah.
And I don't have those feelings anymore. I don't know if that's what it is. I've never actually had to think about why that is. But
yeah, I don't know if it's because of that. Because like I said, I've been in a very happy relationship for a long time now, and I've watched it at least 3 times in the last 2 years.
You could have watched at least 6 viewings of Empire Records in that time.
Or what was the other thing you said?
You're wasting precious hot shots. You're wasting precious hot shots time.
Who's to say who comes out a winner there? But I think it's even a little bit more complicated than just like, oh, I'm sad. I want to watch a movie that will sort of make me feel better about being sad.
I agree with that.
What I like about it is that it kind of runs the whole gamut of emotions you feel in a relationship. And depending on where you are with your romantic life, I've been in the same place for a while now, but I mean, those are the moments that when you see them being genuinely happy with one another. Yeah. And furthermore, even though it's like there are parts of it that are really, really sad, I think it's ultimately
hopeful.
It's ultimately very optimistic. Yeah. And that makes me feel good now in a relationship, and it made me feel good when I wasn't feeling so good, and I was feeling lonely or things like that. I mean, that's why I think to your point about what you were about the way it treats relationships, it's one of the most mature relationship movies movies about relationships has been put out in recent memory, at least in my memory,
and it's done in that really clever way. It's not just a straightforward relationship movie. Blue Valentine was great, very hard to watch, but very straightforward in terms of like, here's this relationship, here it disintegrates, and Eternal Sunshine piles on all this wacky science fiction stuff on top of it, and all the neat sort of forced perspective stuff. And I've seen every Michel Gondry movie now, sort of chasing that.
Yes,
chasing the Eternal Sunshine dragon, only to be let down pretty much every time. I mean, each one of his movies has, I think, things to like about them, but I think he really did a great job with that script. And and so maybe he just needs the right material. I don't know, because he hasn't done a movie that has come close, I don't think.
Very well acted, like I've said about a lot of the other movies we've talked about here. I've never been what you would call a big Kirsten Dunst fan. I think she's really good in this, though.
Yeah.
And it's
her own very interesting kind of subplot, which ties into what the movie's about thematically, but it's not,
is a little bit darker. Hers is actually the most like sort of plot driven part of it. Like, she has to be the one who kind of has to pull the curtain back or whatever.
Right.
And that in a movie that's not overly concerned with that kind of stuff, it could seem sort of forced and kind of like a parlor trick or something, but it doesn't really. Mostly because it just this leads me to the other thing. When she does that, because of the movie's sort of wacky conceit about this mind erasing procedure, it is able to give you emotions and situations that you've literally never seen before, like people who ostensibly in their minds just met each other, and then they are sort of forced to hear the other one saying really awful things about them on a tape. I mean, it's a very sort of on the nose kind of way to make that point, but he was clever enough to invent a scenario where that could happen.
Right, right.
And it's gamely played by both Kate Winslet is great in this movie. I mean, Jim Carrey's good. Jim Carrey's good, but it is the Kate Winslet show.
Yeah.
And they both play that so ably, because, I mean, like, not to get too, like, you know, actorly or whatever, but, like, you know, if you're going to approach this stuff from, like, you know, you're sort of trying to chart, you know, your emotions and how you would react to something and how, you know, people might, I mean, this is like a totally foreign, like, you can't even imagine something like that. Like, someone you just met, you both just met each other, and you have, like, this, you know, hope of starting this relationship, and you get this glimpse, or, well, this, you know, hearing of your relationship's, you know, eulogy, essentially. Everyone, you know, with them complaining about why they wouldn't want to be with you. And like you said, it sort of rounds into form because they decide the last, you know, moments, or he's just like, you know, she says, you know, we're going to mess this up. We know how this ends, and blah, blah. And he's just like, okay, well, let's try it. And
yeah, right.
That's really all you can say. I will always go back to it. I will always hold it in high regard. And just like all of these, that was, I guess that sort of deviates from the primacy thing. Like I said, I told you that wouldn't hold up for very long.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you very much, Alex, for
talking about your
favorite
movies.
We did. We apologize. You know, somebody said last week, maybe in the comments, like, hey, maybe someday you'll get back to doing hour long shows. And we absolutely
did. Yeah.
It's just hard because we have a lot of stuff to cover during these favorite movies shows. And once we get back to just doing, you know, one movie shows, which we will get back to doing, I promise everyone, the running times will shrink back down to a solid hour.
We'll
so stick with us, everybody. Don't forget to enter the Win Our Stuff contest at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget about the F This Movie Fest on February 4th. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie, or visit our site, fthismovie.blogspot.com, for details. Thank you guys very much for listening. Alex, you want to take us out?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for doing this with me, Patrick. You know, we both bring different things to the podcast. It's like technology versus horse.